My name is Jack, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous.
Jack.
Anybody else here love Alcoholics Anonymous?
Absolutely.
Does anybody here love Alcoholics Anonymous?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. Here's the deal. I come up here, and no matter how many times I do this, I'm nervous, and I need energy in the room. And if I don't get it from you guys, it's going to be a hellacious 50 minutes. Okay, so let's try to make some have some fun here. I had my last drink December 7th, 1993, as a result of these steps, you people, and a power greater than myself and great sponsorship. I've been blessed with some incredible men in my years of sobriety. Let's see, I've got a home group. I'm active in my home group. As I mentioned, I have a sponsor, and I sponsor people. It was impressed upon me very early in recovery that if I want to keep this thing, I have to give it away. And I also learned that this thing comes full circle when I do that, and all the rewards come around. And, you know, if you had told me while I was out there running and gunning and doing all those things that, you know, Jack, if you just get out of yourself and you try to help another person, you'd be 100% better. I would have said you are out of your ever-loving mind. You've got to be crazy, but that's exactly how it works. That's the first paradox I learned in this program. Let's see. I grew up with alcoholism in my family. I can tell you that it had absolutely nothing to do with my alcoholism. It just was. I never went without food, and I never went without clothes. But I did spend a great deal of time trying to control my mother's drinking. And from a young age, I think as I look back now and knowing what a resentment is, I think my first resentment was alcohol, because I saw what it did to my mother. And I saw her act disgusting and burn herself and pass out and burn the couch with her cigarettes. And I said, you know, maybe you can relate to this. I'm never going to end up like that, you know. When I was 11 years old, give or take, it's kind of cloudy. The 70s and the 80s kind of like roll together. And I don't really have specifics on that stuff. It got really cloudy. But I would pour out her bottle of whatever it was at the time, the vodka or the scotch. I'd pour some out, and I'd put water in there, and that was my way of controlling it. That's how I thought I could maintain it. I was powerless over alcohol at that point. I couldn't do anything about it. That was my only sense of well-being, of being able to control it. From a very young age, I felt different. I felt less than. I felt left out. I kind of felt like, and I heard this described, And by the way, everything I'm going to share with you, virtually everything I'm going to share with you, things that I've learned about myself or things I've learned from other people, I have very few original thoughts. I'm fortunate that I've heard some great people share in these rooms and have said, wow, that's me, you know, and learn about myself a little bit more because they shared things I didn't even know about myself or expand about it or able to just understand myself a little bit better. But I heard somebody say once that they felt like they were in a bubble and the whole world was out there and they knew what to do and they knew how to behave and they were not scared. They were not worried about what other people thought about themselves. They were the in people, and that was not me. I was an inside wondering what it was like being them. And the only thing that brought me, and I was always self-conscious, and the only thing that would stifle that, at least temporarily, was sports. I was very involved in sports as a young person. That was my first addiction, as I look back. I always had a ball of some kind in my hands, whether a baseball, basketball, a football, a soccer ball, and that's where I got my peace. That was the only time that I ever was here now. You know, I heard Earl say that it's right now, and that's where I need to be, is right there. Instead of worrying about what's happening there or worrying my fear of tomorrow or what happened or what back there. right here and right now was the only time that I could let all that stuff go and be here, right there in that second, in that moment. And I found peace there. But as soon as it was over, all the fears came back until I drank and I had a spiritual experience. And for the first time, I got to be okay with me. You know, I took this drink. It was Schlitz malt. And, yeah, I know. It's funny now, right? Schlitz malt is not funny. It's actually dangerous, probably. But it's so bad. And actually, I drank. Come to think of it, I drank before that. I grew up in Phoenix, and you may have heard that it's hot down there. And I can tell you that it is. It's very hot. And I was, I believe, 13 years old, and it was the summertime, and we were looking for trouble because that's what you do when you're 13 years old, and it's summertime. And we came across a storage shed that was about 6x8, one of those old metal ones that you buy and you put up. It was in a church parking lot. And they stored all the recyclables in there, and the old newspapers. So we opened up this door just to see what was in there, because we weren't supposed to be in there. That was half the fun. And we go in there, and it was probably about 113, 115 outside. It was in June in Phoenix, and that's not uncommon at all. And then we open up this door to this metal building, and this wave of heat. It's like opening up, seriously, like opening up an oven, blasts us in the face. But what we found were some cans of Tall Boy Old Milwaukee. You know, the old 16-ounce, we call them Tall Boys, I guess. They were 16-ounce cans of Old Milwaukee. And as you probably know, beer, as it gets warm, expands. So we had these expanded, what looks like pregnant Old Milwaukee cans. And we drank these things. And I don't remember if I got drunk or not, but I certainly felt a sense of peace, of ease, of comfort that I'd never felt before. And then not long after I did, I found myself, with some of the same fellows drinking Schlitz malt with a straw out of a bottle. The deal was, they said that this guy, back then it was like 75 cents, and you know, we scraped together a dollar, and we had a joint of dirt weed, and the guy said if you put a straw and drink Schlitz malt, you get drunk quicker, and we didn't have much money, and you know, we had to get, you know, it's funny, as I look back, we were drinking for effect immediately. It wasn't like how many 13 or 14-year-olds drink socially, you know. And it worked. And for the first time in my life, I felt okay being me here and now. Just that. You know, I wasn't worried about you were thinking about me. I wasn't worried about, you know, any pimples on my face. I felt attractive. I felt courageous. I just was absolutely okay. It was a spiritual experience, and I knew, I made a decision at that point that I was going to be feeling this way for as long as I could, as often as I could. Now, I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I identify as an alcoholic, and I do that out of respect. I have the utmost respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. The fact of the matter is, I did a lot of drugs. I did mountains of drugs, and I did them in ways that probably aren't even appropriate to mention at the podium. But that is part of my story. I'm not going to elaborate on that. If somebody wants to talk about that after the meeting, I'd be glad to swap those stories with you. That's great. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was raised to identify as an alcoholic in this meeting. Now, when I go to an NA meeting, I identify as an addict, period. I have entirely too much respect for this program and the people that went on before me and the lives that we save to do otherwise. And I can tell you from my experience of burying people that I've sponsored, of knowing people that in this program who didn't make it, that died, that this program saves lives. I don't say that glibly. It is a fact. And because of that, I respect the traditions. You know, my drinking continued, and it was good for a very long time. The consequences weren't too bad. When I started drinking, my grades went to hell, which was you know, brings me up to the next point is potential. I was that kid with potential, which is something that you don't tell an alcoholic, come to find out. Because when somebody said, you know, we don't understand why he behaves like he does. Why does he do these things? He's got such potential. And I thought, you know, okay, I've got potential, right? Well, I know I've got potential. Now you know I've got potential. So if you're so smart, why don't you just leave me the hell alone and take all your sympathies and go wipe it on somebody else? Because if you were so smart, you wouldn't be making $10,000 a year as a guidance counselor now, would you? Now, the way that really came out was, well, I'll try harder next time, actually. But I thought that things would just come to me that I wouldn't have to work for them if I did that, just because I had potential, and that's just not the case. You know, time went on, and I watched, as I'm doing this, I'm watching alcohol destroy my mother, and at the age of 18, she found a solution to her problem. And I'll back up. Our home life had gotten pretty bad. My father, we'd lost pretty much everything, and we were living in we had a retail store, like a retail film store. Back for the people that don't remember, you used to actually take the film out of a camera and go have it processed somewhere. For those of you who can remember that, then you're old like me, and I pity you. But we actually had to take it someplace. It wasn't all digital, and we had a little film store, and behind the film store is where we lived. And my dad had built some bunk beds for my mom and he and myself, and put up a pseudo shower, and we had a two burner stove, and that was our existence. I went outside to play with the dog, to throw the ball with the dog, and I came back in, and there was a big commotion. On that particular day, my aunt was there. Both my aunts were there, and they're supposed to take my mom to see the doctor. I came in the house, and there was a big commotion, and everybody was gathered around the bathroom. I looked in there, and my mom was laying down on the floor, and she had a .22 in her right hand, and she had a bullet hole in her chest, and she had found her solution to alcoholism. And you know, as you can imagine, people were pretty freaked out. And so I picked her up and I put her on the couch, and I did CPR and I did mouth to mouth and all those things. And paramedics finally showed up, and she was alive when she left. And then we got a phone call back saying she didn't make it. And I was pretty distraught by that time. You know, it's crazy what I found, and I don't know if this has any pertains to anything, but what I found, and I've always been involved for whatever reason in a lot of really traumatic situations, I seem to be able to maintain myself for the time being as it's necessary. But when it's over, I tend to go ballistic. And I went ballistic, and the nearest person there was a cop. And I don't recommend going ballistic on a cop. Fortunately, the cop knew what was going on and withheld me without causing bodily harm to me. So he was pretty understanding of it. And when all the cops had left and everything, it was at that point that I'd made a conscious decision about my relationship with God, if there was one. And I looked up at the sky and I told God to F off. I said, you're no longer welcome in this game. This is mine. I'll be doing my thing over here, and you be going doing whatever you want to do over there. You stay the hell out, and we'll be just fine. It was an understanding, the way I saw it. It was a logical understanding. In doing that, it seems, as I look back, that it gave me the freedom. It gave me more freedom to do what I want to do. You see, I've got this thing called a conscience. I'd lost it for a while when I was out there using, but when I turned my life and will over the care of God, I went through this inventory, and I started developing a relationship with God. I started getting this conscience back. When I said goodbye to the God of my limited or no understanding at that time, it freed up, at least a little bit. what I was doing, and I didn't have to behave under the pretense of behaving in a certain manner. And I tore my life to the ground for the next 13 years. And I went out and I did things that frankly, it shouldn't even be brought up at a podium, that I can't even talk about. I should not. It's not appropriate. But I can tell you that it included a lot of violence, a lot of using and abusing of people, 3 DUIs, some time in jail, some overnights, and a lot of self-destruction, a lot of self-endangerment, pushing the envelope a little bit, because at some point I decided I didn't want to live, and then I decided, then I realized that, well, you're not going to anyways, look at the way you're living. And I was quite okay with that. I think my goal was 32 or 34. That was my goal. I'm going to check out by the time I'm 32, 34. So when I made a decision of doing, you know, of that being the case, well, that opened up the door to do all kinds of things. It didn't really matter. You know, I'm going to be gone by the time I'm 32, 34, and I thought it was kind of romantic, kind of like, you know, Hemingway. You know, I thought that was, you know, not... I know, everybody's laughing. They say if you're laughing, you're relating. But that's the insanity of this disease within me. And the rest is, you know, a series of bad decisions and consequences and bad decisions and consequences over and over again. And homelessness and geographics. I did geographics to Illinois, Texas, California, New Mexico, Indianapolis, Wisconsin, Massachusetts. I don't know. I think that's it. New Hampshire. And everywhere I'd go, the MO would be the same, that I would be okay. I'd go, I got to get away from you people because you're a bad influence. My mom always said, if you lay down with dogs, you get fleas. Well, it seems like everywhere I went, I found the dogs right away. Well, what I did... And that's what I thought. I didn't realize is that I was the dog and I was carrying the fleas. So I would go there and I'd be okay for 2 or maybe 3, 4 weeks, and I wouldn't drink even, you know. And then I would just, you know, like I worked hard, you know. I deserve a drink, and I'd have a drink or two, and then I would have, you know, this other substance, and I would leave this other substance, and the next thing you know, I'm. You know, I'm drinking tequila every single night, and I'm slamming dope, and I'm using, trying to find barbiturates or benzodiazepines to come back down, you know, so I can get to work the next day and start the cycle all over again, and around, and the cycle of spree and remorse as it talks about in the doctor's opinion. On and on and on again. At the age of 31, I could not take it anymore. And the blinders had been lifted. See, for so long, it was always somebody else's fault. It was always the cop's fault. It was the judge's fault. They're out to get me. It was my mother's death. That was a good one. I used that. I got a lot of sympathy out of that at the bar. But it was never me. And then when I was 31, I don't know, 30, 19, 92 or something like that, 92 or 93, excuse me, 92 or 93, I realized that I was the problem, and that became real difficult. And it went from alcohol would get me where I needed to go, and then it slowly, it would just barely take the edge off, as it were. And then I would drink, and I would either end up at the end, the guy at the end of the bar, the sappy, self-pity, crying his beer drunk, or I was fighting, and there was rarely anything in between. And it talks about me in the book and on every single page somewhere. I don't know where that is, but you know, that was me. And I couldn't take it anymore, so I reasoned, well, I can't live like this anymore. I tried to moderate. That's funny. My inside joke. I tried O'Doul's. I don't know, has anybody here, you've heard of O'Doul's, those other non-alcoholic drinks, right? Okay, well, I'll just drink O'Doul's, and I go to the bar, and I put away a couple of those. And I'm like, and I say, this is stupid, because I'm getting bloated, I'm not getting drunk, and I basically throw it back at the bartender, and I said, give me two shots of Cuervo and a Miller back, because that was my M.O., two shots of Cuervo, get that pump going right away, man, and a Miller back. Thank you, God. You know, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about it so well for me. It says that we are restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience the ease and comfort that come from taking a few drinks at once. And that was me. I was a functioning drunk. I don't know if there's such a thing, but I up until the last 6 months, 6 or 9 months of my using, drinking, I would work, but while I was working, this obsession of drinking was on my mind, drinking and using all through the day, right? And like, how am I going to get it? Where am I going to get it? Where am I going to use it? Where am I going to get the money to get it? Would go on and on and on and on, and then when I would leave work, now all of a sudden it became real that I was going to get drunk, that this ease and comfort was going to come, and I would get to the bar and I would sit down. And I'd hear that. And that ease and comfort came already. It was starting to come already. And if you can relate, you belong in this meeting. All that noise up here was starting to go away a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. Boom, I put a shot back, and I put a half a beer down in one swig, and I was good. I was good. And I had a smile, and I loved everybody. We are the world. And boy, worry at the stumble on in Fox Lake, Illinois. But that was me. I didn't need to get drunk. I just needed to be near it. That ease and comfort came at once by taking a few drinks. And it didn't work anymore. The ease and comfort didn't work anymore. And I decided, well, you know, I can't, the O'Doul's deal is not working. I called a treatment center, and they said, well, have you got $30,000? And I said, if I had $30,000, I wouldn't be calling you, would I? I never understood that. And I said, well, I can't go on like this. Wait a minute. If you're dead, you don't have to deal with it anymore. And that, in my mind, was logical. Now, I had spent the last 13 years, you know, bemoaning my mom and how selfish she was and what she did to us, wham, 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 getting on the cross. But now all of a sudden, I get it. When the pain gets so great, I can go down two paths. I can pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools, or I can just put a gun to my head. And that's the decision that I made. And I didn't want to make a big mess, and I didn't want to involve anybody that I had more than I had to, but at any rate, I sent my hostage slash girlfriend out for the night, and I got a big bag of white powder, and I got a bottle of rum, because I was in the marketing business at that time. Of course, they call it something different now. I think it's possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance, but... And I got these things together, and I made a decision to take my life, and I blacked out, and it wasn't necessarily rare that I blacked out, but it didn't happen like that usually. Usually my blackouts occurred, the only thing I remembered was leaving the bar at night, and I don't remember the drive home most of the time. And you remember this, you know, or burning your hand with a cigarette to try to stay awake and not pass out, and maybe somebody... No, I didn't do it either. I just thought maybe it was... just throwing that out there. But I came to. I don't know if I fell asleep. I think I came to in the morning after, and an interesting thing happened. I was sitting against the wall, and the sun burst through the big sliding glass door we had on the second floor, and it was lines shining right on me, and a little voice deep down inside me said, "Jack, you're a drug addict and an alcoholic." And it was eye-opening for me. I don't know if I ever seriously contemplated that being the case or not, but it was really, it was like a slap in the forehead. You know, oh my God. And I was so relieved. It was like having an ache in my knee all these years and then finally going to the doctor and saying, "Hey, this is what the problem is." You know, it was a genuine sense of relief. And so I went out and celebrated for another 6 months. And that didn't prove to be very beneficial. The next 6 months were a series of detoxes and treatment centers. And on December 6th of 1993, I was in Tempe, Arizona, living with a guy, living on the floor of his house. I was virtually homeless. And he was paying for our drugs, he was paying for our alcohol, paying for our cigarettes. He just didn't want to be alone in his misery. He had money coming in. His parents were enabling him. And he just didn't want to be miserable alone. And I looked at him and I said, "You know, if we continue doing this, one or both of us is going to die. And for the first time in a very long time, I don't want to die." And he happened to have a cell phone. It was one of those briefcase things that's about this big. And he picked up the phone and he called the detox. And most detoxes I've dealt with are like this, that you have to call them and say, "Hey, I need a bed. I want to get in there." Well, you know, most of the time those people are desperate at that moment. So what they do is they tell you, "Look, you call every hour on the hour, because we don't have one available, just to see how willing you are." And I did, and I called. And on the next day, at 5-ish, December 7th of 1993, I went to, it's called EVAC, East Valley Alcoholism Council. And everything I owned was in a big garbage bag. And I sat down there, I dropped the bag down, I broke down in tears. And I knew the jig was up. I knew that this is my last shot at life, and that what I'd had before was an existence, and I had been beaten into a state of reasonableness, as the book says. And if you had told me, "You know, Jack, you need to run laps around the building 24/7 to stay sober," I always said, "Fantastic." Or as my sponsor said, "If you want to stay sober, get in the corner with that bucket of sand and eat sand." I would have said, "Can I use a fork or should I use a spoon?" And that's the state of willingness that I was in. I got into a treatment center 9 days later after shakes had stopped enough and the whatever, the other things had stopped, that I should not have gotten into. I couldn't afford a treatment center. And I learned about myself, but what I learned is, if you don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to die. Period. And it was a 12-step based program, and we had people come in from the outside and bring us meetings, and they said, "Get a sponsor before you leave." And somewhere I'm so. I don't know, arrogant or willing or something, that we had different types of meetings come in. We had CAAA, NA, Overeaters Anonymous. We had whatever they were, and I got a phone number from each one of these people, and I was going to get them to sponsor me. Now, I don't think I had issues in any of that stuff, but I wanted to make sure that I got this thing. Of course, when I got out, I didn't call any of them. And at about 88 days of sobriety, I think it was 88 days of sobriety, give or take, I didn't want to drink, but I got crazy. And I picked up, I'd been to some outside meetings, and I get a phone number from a guy. And I opened up my wallet, and there's a phone number. I said, "James R." And I didn't know who he was. But I said, James, it's Jack. I met you at a meeting. You probably don't remember me. He said, oh, Jack, fantastic. I'm glad you called. He remembered me. And he said, what's going on? I said, I need to get to a meeting. I live way out in Gilbert. I don't have a car. And and James came and picked me up. Now, James, at that time, had about 7 years of sobriety, and he was a good-looking guy. He was a handsome man, and he came out in a 1976 Chery Trans Am. I mean, a bandit, right? I mean, just Chery, all right? And I was so impressed by this. And my first thought was attraction before promotion, right? This guy's got something that I want. And it was great. And he took me, we went to a movie, went to a car show, we went to a meeting. And he took me out into the world. And that's what he continued to do. We got together once a week, and he'd give me an assignment. He'd say, read this in the big book. And then we'd sit down once a week. We'd go over what we read, which is great because my head was scrambled eggs still. He'd explain it to me. And he began to take me through the steps. He did not hear my fifth step. He did not hear my fifth step because he belonged to a religious denomination. And when it came time, and I said, look, you know, I got this thing that, you know, I need to share. And he said, well, you got to share it with a priest. And I said, why? He says, because the book tells you so. And I said, where does it say that? He says, read the book. So we parted ways, which was okay. And I found somebody who actually had less time than I, but had something that I wanted, and had been through the steps, and had taken men through the steps. He belonged to, they call them Akronites. They do it the way they did in Akron back in the day, where you go in and you go through the steps, boom, in a day. And it was incredible. You know, he had taken me through a four-step out of the book, the way it says in the book, and I reviewed, and, you know, I did... You know, as my sponsor puts it so simply, he said it's a series of writings, observations, and prayers. Is the inventory. Writing, observations, and prayers. And if a person does that, excuse me, when I did that, what happened in the fifth step was really just an admission of everything that I already learned. I already knew what the exact nature of my wrongs were. I knew what my defects were. I knew that my life was fear-based. That I was fear-based, self-centered fear, fear of losing what I had or not getting what I want. It was just a matter of getting it off my chest and the incredible relief that comes from that, relief from letting go of that burden. From that list, I came up with an 8-step list. I read the 8-step and the 12 and 12. I added to that list. I came to him with it, and he looked at it. I'll never forget this. It was like it was yesterday, and this was, you know, what, 21 years ago or something. He looks at it and he starts laughing and he starts crossing out these. Because I had 142 names, institutions, and principles on my original inventory. I didn't think it was funny at all. there was a lot of work there. He starts crossing out these names, you know, because I had, you know, almost all my resentments. There was an amends necessary, or so I thought. Plus the ones I added from the 8-step. And he starts crossing them off and laughing. And he says, this is Jack. You need to get over yourself. You're not that important. There's no way you could affect this many people. And that was a good lesson. I needed to hear that. I needed to hear that. I'm not that important. And then he said, prior to that, when we did the 7-step, we did it on our knees together. We said the 7-step prayer, and we got up, and he said, now you have a clean slate. And we made my list. We talked about 9 and about how the proper way to make an amends, and explaining to me that you're not sorry. He said, actually, you are sorry, but you're working your way towards not being a sorry individual. All right? And what does an amend mean? It means to make right something that was wrong. And we're going to go to these people, and we're going to try to write to the best of our ability what we can do to mend that relationship, pay back this money. And I set about doing those things, and then got caught up in some sordid affairs. You know, I'm no stranger to unhealthy relationships. There's a good reason why that, you know, it's not in the big book, but you hear people say don't get into a relationship for a year. I don't tell my guys that. I tell them do not share yourself with another individual until you've been through the steps and they have. How dare I share myself with another person until I find out at least somewhat of an idea of who I am? Otherwise, I'm just bringing a mess and I'm sharing bodily fluids. You know, and maybe that sounds a little crass, but that's really what I'm doing. And I see it happening all the time, and I did the same thing. I did the same thing, and I had to go back and I make amends to it, and I created a mess. And you know, I grew from that, and I got into a position. Let's see, 1995. I was diagnosed with hepatitis C. Back in those days, 50% of the people are diagnosed with it. It progresses, and you end up getting a liver transplant, or you just die. So it was a bit of a death sentence, and I had been going through the steps. I made growth. I got my license back, and I felt good about myself for the first time in maybe forever. And so I was crushed by this news. And I went to a meeting, and I shared about it. And then I probably shared it at this group, you know, what happened. But after I shared this, and I broke down and I cried, a woman with a whole bunch of time in this program, she had 20-plus years to my 1 year or 2 years, whatever it was, slid a little note across the table and said, tears are a spiritual bath. And I'll never forget that. Because what I found... I was raised from that same belief system that men don't cry. Men don't cry. You just don't do that. Especially out on the street, because that's a sign of weakness and they'll eat you up. And where I came from, that's exactly what they did and they would do. But I come into here and I bear my soul to you people. And you bear yours to mine. And I find incredible peace, honesty, and I can relate, and I can be of service to other people. When I am humble, I'm more near my Creator than I ever am. And that's where I need to be, is right next to my Creator, my God. And I heard this explained the other day. I've never heard anybody explain it the way that I feel. And it was Jim, that my God is like the ultimate grandfather, who in his wisdom and in his grace gave me self-will and said, here, I love you. Now go out and do your life. Now I'm going to be here the whole time. And I know you're going to screw up, but that's okay, because that's how you're going to learn. And you go out and you do that, and when you screw up and when you're in pain, you come back here and you sit on my knee and I'm going to hold you. And we're going to walk through it together. And when I'm in pain, I go back to my grandfather's knee. And he holds me, and we get through it. And when I'm in joy, and I'm crying tears of gratitude, which I wish upon everybody at least once to try to cry tears of gratitude, it's the same deal. We celebrate together. Because without him, none of it would have been anyways. The gifts that this program has given me, there's not enough time. I could speak about 3 hours just talking about the gifts that this program has given me. And I think that is probably the greatest thing I could talk about. You know, how do you go from, you know, sitting in a trashy apartment complex laundry room, shooting dope in my veins at 3 a.m, to where I'm at today without a loving God and you people, these steps and great sponsorship. That's what it is. What a gift. So he said, you got hepatitis C, and my talked to my brother, and he had actually kicked me out of his house sometime before when he had enough of my using and said, I don't want you around my family anymore. We're done with you. And I talked to him about this Hep C thing, and he said, why don't you come over here and live with us, and we'll go through the treatment together. We'll support you as you go through it. It wasn't great, the treatment. It sucked on many occasions. But here's the funny thing. The coincidence, as it were. When I moved there, I tell you the first thing I did, I got into town in September of 97 on a Saturday at about 3 in the morning. And I woke up and I looked in the directory and there's a 10 o'clock meeting, and I went to that 10 o'clock meeting nearby. And then he told me about a men's group that meets that next Friday. Well, I went to a few meetings in between. I went to the Friday meeting, and I found a sponsor. Now, I'll tell you why I did that, because they told me, and I knew from experience, how easy it is to get off this AA beam. And I get plugged in right away. And I did, and I got the sponsor, and like a week later, my sponsor was, I don't know, 15 years older than me, like a different generation. Stories didn't match, and I'm sitting back thinking, what the hell am I doing with this guy as a sponsor? I got nothing in common with him, and that's got nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. In fact, I can tell you from experience that I sponsor a man right now that we are quite a bit different in our past, but it doesn't matter. We share the same hope. I love that man and buried him about a year ago. He died of cancer. But he was a beautiful man. In 1999, I met my wife after obsessing about women and relationships, mostly about relationships and being alone, to the point where I'd lost all my serenity. I couldn't go to a meeting with any peace because I was always looking at her. You know, maybe she's the one. It's her, you know. And it got to the point where I wasn't getting anything out of the meetings. There was no serenity. And I looked up and I said, God, I can't take this anymore. You got to take this from me. I can't bear this anymore. And I got to a point not long thereafter where it's absolutely okay being by myself for the first time in my life. It was really weird. I was okay being by myself today, and if it was going to be that way tomorrow or down the line, I was okay. And sure enough, that's when I met my wife, about a week after that. And the funny thing is that she was nothing like I had dated in the past. She was a... she was not trailer trash. That was my MO. And she was a professional woman. You know, she was beautiful. She was dressed professionally. I thought in the back of my mind, Jack, you are way out of your league here, man. The bar is way up here. And so much so that when I asked her out the first time, I stuttered. And I'd never done that before. Because there was no way, I didn't have to rescue her. I didn't have to, fix her in any way. She was already fixed. We had our first child in 2001, and that was an incredible experience. I wasn't there for the labor to speak of. I was there in the room, but I just can't be present mentally for big things. I just can't handle it, I guess. But when she was born and they handed my girl to me, I lost it. I can't even imagine. And we had our boy the year after. We had Irish twins. Because I was supposed to go through hepatitis C treatment again, and they said they can't go through it. You can't have children going through it. So we had to stack them up, or we'd have to wait like 2 years or something like that. I forgot what it was. Since then, let's see, my son was born, and 3 weeks after he was born, he had emergency surgery. He wasn't digesting food. He wasn't gaining weight. And he was he was a rail, skinny as a rail, and he was only 3 weeks old. And my wife said, she was at the hospital and said, "Look, you got to get here now. Jack is going to have emergency surgery." And my first thought was fear, and then my second thought was, "Okay, what am I supposed to do here? What have I been taught? Okay, God's will. Pray for God's will to be done." I couldn't do it. I couldn't pray for God's will to be done, and it had been fine in the past. You know, when it came to somebody else or a sponsee or somebody else's child or a sponsor. But this is my son. This is my namesake, Jack Pierce III, and I'm not ready to let him go. So I called up my sponsor, and I told him what was going on. I said, "Look, Stan, I can't pray for God's will to be done. I want my boy. I don't, honestly don't give a rat's ass what God's will is. I want my boy." He said, "That's okay, Jack." And he said it in that way because he knew I'd always already beaten myself up because I couldn't go that route and that I was PO'd. He said, "You pray for acceptance of God's will, and we'll pray for God's will to be done on this end." And that made sense to me. And I spent the trip from wherever I was at, driving probably like a maniac to the hospital, praying for acceptance of God's will to be done in my life. Acceptance of it. And by the time I got to the hospital, I was calm enough, and my wife, maybe I wasn't, but I believe I was calm enough that I could be there for my wife and in a capacity that I needed to be as a husband and as a father, rather than a hysterical person. And my husband and my son got through it. He got through it, and I had to sit with him in the recovery room for, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 hours. And he couldn't eat that whole time. Now, for those of you who don't have children, children that young communicate in one way. They cry. They're hungry, they cry. They're tired, they cry. They're thirsty, they cry. He had not eaten for hours before the surgery. We had surgery, and when he woke up for anesthesia, he wanted to eat, and he cried. He cried. He cried. He cried, and I sat in there in that room with him while he cried, and I couldn't do anything about it. And it's only by the grace of God, and I don't say that lightly, it's only by the grace of God that I was able to do there and be there and handle that for that period of time. And then after we could feed him, he turned into we call him Buddha Baby. And he just started growing like a balloon from the neck down, even the neck up. He just grew and grew and grew. It was a wonderful thing to see. You know, since then, some of the highlights of my recovery, like I said, I buried two sponsors. I buried two sponsees that just couldn't do this deal. And I hate to see anybody pass away, and I hate to see the people around them suffer because they're the ones that have to live on in pain. But here's the truth. When those things happen, they become lessons for us, particularly for Jack. And I can see those things and say, wow, this is real. This is real. This will freaking kill you. I need to see those. One of the guys that sponsored, I don't know how he pulled this off. He got two DUIs in one night. How do you do that? What was that guy's name? He ended up killing himself by taking his motorcycle into a telephone pole at 80 miles an hour. And that was an open casket funeral that should not have been open casket. About 3 weeks after the funeral, his mother called me and thanked me. And wanted to say, she said, "I just want to thank you, everything he said about you and everything you tried to do to help him. And I'm sure he'd want you to know that, and I thank you for all the help that you gave him." I don't want those calls. Sure, it felt good, but I don't want those calls. I do love Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's something I'd like to hopefully share with you. Huh. In 1943, at the fourth anniversary of the Chicago Group, Alcoholics Anonymous, a man gave a speech by the name of Judge John T. And one of the things that came out of that was the following, and I'm going to share that with you because it's near and dear to my heart. I hope that I hope you find the love in it that I have. Maybe I can pull it off without crying, but we'll see. God in His wisdom has selected a group of men to be the purveyors of His goodness. In selecting them through whom to bring about this phenomenon, He went not to the proud, the mighty, the famous, or the brilliant. He went to the humble, to the sick, to the unfortunate. He went to the drunkard, the so-called weakling of the world. Well might He have said to us, "Into your weak and feeble hands I have entrusted a power beyond estimate. To you has been given that which has been denied the most learned of your fellows. Not to scientists or statesmen, nor to wives or mothers, not even to my priests and ministers have I given this gift of healing other alcoholics, which I entrust to you. It must be used unselfishly. It carries with it grave responsibility. No day can be too long, no demands upon your time can be too urgent, no case too pitiable, no task too hard, no effort too great. It must be used with tolerance, for I have restricted its application to no race, no creed, and no denomination. Personal criticism you must expect. Lack of appreciation will be common. Ridicule will be your lot. Your motives will be misjudged. Success will not always attend your efforts in your work with other alcoholics. You must be prepared for adversity, for what men call adversity is the ladder you must use to ascend the rungs toward spiritual perfection. And remember, in the exercise of this power, I shall not exact from you from beyond your capabilities. You're not selected because of exceptional talents, and be careful always if success attends your efforts not to ascribe to personal superiority that to which you can lay claim only by virtue of my gift. If I had wanted learned men to accomplish this mission, the power would have been entrusted to the physician and scientist. If I had wanted eloquent men, there would have been many anxious for the assignment, for talk is the easiest used of all talents with which I have endowed mankind. If I wanted scholarly men, the world is filled with better qualified than you who would have been available. You were selected because you have been the outcast of the world, and your long experience as a drunkard has made or should make you humbly alert to the cries of distress. You come from the hearts, lonely hearts of alcoholics everywhere. Keep ever in mind the admission that you made on the day of your profession into AA, namely that you are powerless and that it is only with your willingness to turn your life and will into my keeping that relief came to you. I thank you all from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.